The subtitle, the post-colon part of the title tonight, the true meaning of Pesach is a tall order. Maybe it should be a true meaning of Pesach. I don't mean by this learning this evening to preclude other takes, but I do want to take us through a number of sources and ways of thinking about this that may add a dimension that perhaps we don't think about or perhaps we don't think about as deeply as we might. So I think if you ask people, what's Pesach basically about? One of the first words that jumps to mind is freedom. Right? The idea that we are celebrating our freedom, we're celebrating our liberation, and that is the essence of what this holiday is. And we find that manifested in a number of ways. I just want to point out three. The first is the Mishnah in Pesachim, which is the first source on your text, when it describes what it is we are thanking, extolling, all of these verbs, right? Lehodot, le'ale, le'shabech, le'fa'er, le'romem, le'hader, le'varech, le'aleu, kales. This kind of over-the-top energy directed towards God. And we want to name, well, what is it that we're responding to? The very first thing that the Mishnah says is, Hotzianu me'avdut le'cheirut. You took us out from slavery to cheirut, to freedom. Right? That's the sort of most over-the-top frame. This is the Mishnah's description of what we say and what we in fact say at the end of Magid. On some level, if someone were coming to a Seder and kind of zoning out, and not saying any of you have ever done this, and don't pay any attention to every word along the way, and then you're waiting for the crescendo, right, the final moment of Magid, you would easily walk away from this passage saying, I get it. This is about Hotzianu me'avdut l'cheirut. This is about going from slavery to freedom. When we daven, when we say Birkat HaMazon, whenever we refer to the holiday liturgically, we say Yom Chag HaMatzot HaZeh Zman Cheiruteinu. It is the time of our liberation, of our freedom. And that also reinforces that. And perhaps most dramatically, when we project how the experience of Pesach is in some way a paradigm or a model going forward for how it might affect our lives, which we do kind of tucked away in Aramaic in the Halach Ma'anya right at the beginning, we say, Hashata avdei l'shana haba'a b'nei chorin. This year we are slaves, such an interesting thing to say, right, sitting on the other end of the liberation that we're celebrating. Next year we will be free. And that's as powerful a statement as you can imagine of what we intend this experience to be, what we understand this experience to infuse us with, is some kind of model of thinking about liberation. Right? And that's the simple answer, that what we're celebrating is slavery to freedom. So that's precisely the kind of surface-level reading that I want to complicate and would like to nuance in terms of either suggesting that perhaps it's not really about that, or more precisely, the freedom that we're celebrating is considerably more complicated. And some of this, I think, will be very familiar to many of us as close readers of the Torah and of aspects of the Haggadah. But I want to draw us deeper into what the ramifications of this idea of perhaps going from one sort of slavery to another, me'avdut le'avdut in a certain sense, might mean for us. So we're going to look at a few sources that complicate that kind of from within the biblical and rabbinic narrative. And then I want to give at least some time to a beautiful and powerful passage by Rav Yitzchak Huttner, which I'll say more about when we get into it, who really develops this concept much more robustly. So a few things. The obvious thing, which I think any child who learns through the story of the Torah, not the Haggadah's telling, but actually learns through the narrative of the Torah, can't fail to notice is, of course, Moshe's constant turning to Paro, which begins with a request for some kind of emancipation, Shalach et ami, but then, of course, always ends with the phrase, V'yavduni, so that they may serve me. And it's something we hear kind of so quickly, I think we forget, that it is the very same verb that is the source of all of the oppression of the Jewish people in the book of Shemot. The thing that makes the people scream out, makes their screams go up, is the avodah. The thing that they crush us with is avodah, Ein Bet Dalet, that kind of work. And the exact thing that Moshe asks the people to be allowed to do is Avodah. Ve'yavduni, to be sent out, perhaps complicating the notion of being liberated, in order to serve. Right, that's sort of just the first point here, that the telos of this whole Yitziat Mitzrayim narrative is towards some kind of Avodah as opposed to just away from Avodah. Right, here's the second question. How do you say free in biblical Hebrew? It's not Ben-Chorin. That's an Aramaic kind of term. How do you say, right, to free a slave is l'shachrer in Aramaicized Hebrew? But that's not a biblical term. How do you say free? Sorry, chofshi. Chofshi. Okay, where do we find chofshi? Where does that term come up? L'chofshi yishalchenu tachat shino. Yishalchenu chofshi me'imach. When we talk about the emancipation of slaves, we use this verb, this adjective of chofshi, to describe them being sent out into some kind of freedom. Good. Where else is, what about the abstract term for freedom? How would you say that in biblical Hebrew?
Dror.
Dror, good. So dror is one way, the notion of liberty. It's a very unusual word that doesn't appear in lots of places. So that's one abstract term. And another is the form chufsha. Which is O chufsha lo nitan la, the Torah talking in one place about a female slave who has not been emancipated says she has not been sent into a stage of chufsha. All right, this term chet pe shin is clearly the basic biblical equivalent of ben chorin. At least it seems that is the way you talk about freedom. It is used that way for emancipating slaves. That root is never used anywhere in the Tanakh to describe anything having to do with Yitziat Mitzrayim. It's a very simple and very striking point that the verb that is used to describe freedom is not used when describing what happens to the Israelites when they leave Mitzrayim and go on their journey to be with God and to end up in their land. Okay? If anything, when you see the other places where Chofesh is used, you can see perhaps why that is so. In one of the narratives around Shaul and David, when Shaul wants to incentivize someone to go out and do an important military act that's needed at the moment, he says anyone who does this will have his house chofshi. His house will be free. And the very clear context there is he will be relieved of his head tax for the king. That is to say, what it is to be bechofesh, bechufsha, is to essentially be free from any kind of coercion. Right? In that sense, actually, the modern usage in Hebrew of using chofshi to mean secular, which it is used often in the sense of I am unbound by religious obligations and expectations, is actually not a bad translation of the usage of it in the Torah, which means you're no longer my problem, I have nothing to do with you, that slave has been sent out, they're free, I won't collect taxes from you, there are no burdens on you. Okay? So the notion that should make us wonder if this word of chofesh and chufsha does not appear anywhere in Yitziat Mitzrayim, tells us something perhaps about whether the underlying message is freedom, at least as connoted by that root. Now, here's the most important point. And these are psukim that I think are familiar to many, but I'm not sure we often feel their full impact. So here, these I didn't translate because I wanted to maintain kind of the ambiguity of the original, but you'll see in the next rabbinic sources that I have, they'll come out, but I'll render them here. Vayikra Kafhe, 25th chapter of Leviticus, is discussing all kinds of laws in the Israelite polity with respect to those who become poor and as a result are reduced to some kind of servitude. And the Torah says, if one of your brethren becomes poor, becomes low, and as a result is sold to you, right? You would sell yourself off in order to pay off your debts, a kind of indentured servitude, to pay back that which you owe in which you don't have enough liquid capital to pay back, you don't have any land. He'll work with you until the Jubilee year, and then he will go out he and his children with him and go back to his family and to the holdings of his fathers. Why? Ki avadayhem asher otzeiti otam me'eretz Mitzrayim lo yimachru mimkeret aved. Because they are my slaves, says the Torah here, says God here. They are my slaves that I have taken out of Eretz Mitzrayim. Therefore, they cannot be sold like a slave. We'll see a text that will unpack that in a moment. And then a few verses later, if you didn't get the point, ki li v'nei Yisrael havadim. Because the children of Israel, the Israelites, are slaves to me. Avadayhem asher otzeiti otam me'eretz Mitzrayim. Avadim ayinu lefaro b'mitzrayim. We were slaves to Paro in Egypt, and now we are slaves to God. Right? That seems very clearly to be the plain sense of this verse. And I actually think this is hinted at a few verses later at the beginning of Parshat Bechukotai here in Vayikra Kaf Vav. Ani Hashem Elokeichem. I am the Lord your God. Asher otzeiti atchem me'eretz Mitzrayim, who took you out of Eretz Mitzrayim. Mihyot lahem avadim. So that you would not be slaves to them. Not so that you would not be slaves. Not so that you would be liberated, but that you would not be slaves to them. Instead, you will be slaves to me. Or whatever Eved means. Whatever Avadim, whatever that state of being with respect to a master means, and whether it means the same thing with respect to Paro and God, it's part of what we'll engage here. But there is a very clear sense that the journey is not one from at least biblical slavery to biblical freedom. Whatever we mean by avdut lecheirut, we clearly mean something beyond being released from taxes, being allowed to do whatever we want. There is some kind of transition from one domain to another. And if you see this, the Sifra, the early Midrash Halacha on the book of Vayikra, here in the second source from the bottom, explains how this works. Ki avadayhem, why does God claiming the Israelites as slaves result in the legal consequence that they should not and indeed cannot purchase one another as slaves? Shtari kadam aleihem rishon. God essentially says, I have a prior writ on these people. If you try to buy a fellow Israelite, right, what's the standard rules in mekach u'memkar, the standard rules in monetary law is if someone sells something to someone else, and you have proof that actually you own that thing first, such that the seller has no right to sell it. Similarly, God whips out the title, right? Whips out the deed that God holds on each and every Jew as a result of the Exodus, and therefore can preempt the sale of any Jew to another as being void and illegitimate. But that is only possible because, on some level, the claim that God makes is not one of just religious opportunity, religious relationship, but actually some kind of claim of ownership in a deep way, which once Paro held, but now God holds in a more intensive way. Okay? Let's just pause here for a second if there are any thoughts or questions on that move, and then I want to take it and develop it a little further. Please.
The slave in Mitzrayim, I assume, had no autonomy.
Yeah, this is a great, great question. So I want to come to that in a minute. I think part of the question of, is there a place for autonomy in a condition of slavery, and are there different kinds of slavery that allow different levels or different aspects of autonomy? So one thing that's striking, right, in the biblical verse there, where I pointed to this, mihyot lahem avadim, that you not be slaves to them, but on some level are to me. The end of that phrase is very, I think, indicative of an attitude, at least. Vayishbor motot ulchem va'olech etchem koma miyut. There is something literally, and I broke the yokes off of your neck and let you walk upright. Right? So there is something about the slavery or the servitude to God that allows a certain degree of dignity, of walking upright as a person, which apparently the slavery to Egypt did not. And maybe that's the nature of the task given. Maybe that's the nature of how it's being engaged. But there's some notion there, I don't think it quite gets to autonomy, but that there's a full realization of the person in the relationship of being an Eved to God in a way that there's not with Paro.
Yeah, you want?
Even though we accept all Malchut Shemayim?
Well, that's why I said I'm not sure that point gets to autonomy, but I'm pointing out that even as the Torah in that very passage is saying you were slaves here, slaves there, there's still something dramatically different. Right? For that matter, the very laws of being an Eved Ivri, a Hebrew slave, are themselves intended to imbue that kind of master-servant relationship with some greater dignity than otherwise would have been the default. Now, the autonomy piece, I think where it's going to go to, and this is where I want to turn to now, really is a question of, does one define autonomy as, I can do whatever I want to do? Or does one define autonomy as, I have the freedom of movement to become who I ought to be? Those are two very different formulations.
Can you do those again?
Yeah, say them one more time. Two ways of thinking about the notion of autonomy or the space for the individual. One is that autonomy is about, and I'll just introduce this terminology here, which we'll get to in a minute, by Isaiah Berlin. One notion is what Isaiah Berlin, a 20th century philosopher, referred to as negative liberty. Negative liberty is the notion that you can't stop me from doing something that I want to do. Right? Autonomy as defined under a negative liberty scheme means if I am not able to do something, then I'm not truly free. Negative liberty means you do not prevent me. If I want to run my car through a red light, if I had true liberty in that sense, I would be able to do it. And the state's decision that that is illegal and that they will fine me or throw me in jail for doing that is an encroachment on that kind of negative liberty. Negative here doesn't mean bad, right? Just negative in the sense of it's about a freedom. It's about not stopping me, holding back from restricting my movements. It is impossible within a framework of Kabbalat Ol Mitzvot and some notion of accepting commands, restrictions, etc., to understand the transition from Paro to some kind of religious domain mastered by God to be a journey to that kind of autonomy. Right? That, I think, is pretty clear. The question is whether we might engage a different notion of what it is to be autonomous and free. This is what Berlin referred to as positive liberty, which is essentially freeing me from constraints that are not enabling me to be who I ought to be or who I could be. That is to say, when I invest in my child to have music lessons or to engage in intense learning of a language, there are all kinds of restrictions that that places on that child's time. There are all kinds of expectations that are bound up with that kind of investment. But one could make an argument, and certainly what Berlin would say is the notion of positive liberty would say that indeed many of those restrictions and many of those encroachments on that child's negative liberty will to a certain degree advance the positive liberty and unleash the kind of creative forces from within. But those two are not the same. Not only are they not the same, they're potentially in tension in a very meaningful way. The same red light that's an encroachment on what I feel like doing may actually be key to unleashing a society's ability to actually be a more healthy, thriving, and in a certain sense, free place. When Mayor de Blasio suddenly says we're going to lower the speed limit from 30 to 25 on all of the streets in Manhattan, as a driver, when I first hear that, I have a negative liberty instinct to say that's really annoying. That's going to take me a couple more minutes, probably a couple more seconds, you know, to get from this place to that. And we have an instinctive revulsion, I think, often, to things that seem to constrict us in that kind of a way. But, of course, the goal of a law like that, to the extent it's successful, is to say we will all, in some sense, be freer and more fully realized in a positive sense by having a society where pedestrians are not killed. And to the extent that that can help advance that goal, it will. Okay, so this I think is the question then, if we've at least complicated the notion that the Torah does not seem to talk about the journey of Yetziat Mitzrayim as one that maximizes negative liberty, then what is it talking about? What is it thinking about when it says ki avadaihem? And you have this very kind of pre-Berlin but statement of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, where he says, a slave of God cannot be a slave to others. Slavery to God is liberating. Okay, now we'll come back to the quote from Berlin on this that I think illuminates this. You can hear some of the Orwellian possibilities here in this kind of a language when you start talking about liberty as something that can be generated by actually coercing people to do all sorts of things. But Rav Hirsch clearly is getting at something here, which is ki avadaihem in the Torah is talking about being servants or slaves to God, and yet clearly in a context that is about some kind of liberation from the Egyptian regime. And so we have to understand what that's about. Okay, yeah.
How does positive liberty differ from common sense?
How does positive liberty differ from common sense? Well, I think, certainly on a social level, positive liberty is something that might have to be safeguarded and even regulated by some kind of broader apparatus than just what the individual feels they want to do at that moment. And that probably requires some degree of things we would call coercion in one way or another. They might not be oppressive coercion. They might not even be involuntary in the sense that someone might sign on to them as recognizing them as a path towards flourishing. But I think the notion is positive liberty demands some vision of a kind of, you know, a vision of the good life that people ought to be directed to, which won't just result by giving people some set of infinite choices that they pursue as they please. So there's something beyond, that doesn't mean it can't or shouldn't align with common sense, but it is different from, I'm not going to tell you what to do. That's, I think, some of the difference. Okay, so let's look now, I want to look at the word chirut here, actually, for a minute, which is the last way that I want to complicate this. Remember, this word, chirut, ben chorin, this notion of becoming free, is what we say at the crescendo moment of the Haggadah, and yet I'm suggesting to you that it doesn't mean, at least simply, what you might have thought of at first, which is some negative liberty notion of freedom, I don't have to pay taxes, thank God, I'm out of jail, there's nothing more I need to worry about. But the word chayrut, I think sometimes we perhaps don't quite understand as precisely as we ought to. So here, let's go to that Eved Ivri passage. Here we're on the second page in the book of Shmot. And for the next source, I'm going to ask someone to read for me. This is the scene where the Torah says at the beginning of Parshat Mishpatim, Ki tikne Eved Ivri sheshanim ya'avodu vashvi'it yetzei lachofshi chinam. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he will work for you for 6 years, and on the seventh year, he goes out chofshi. Again, there is that word of chofshi, free, going out free. However, though the general rule is the slave goes out by himself and must leave behind any family members he picked up while a slave, if his master gives him a wife and he has children with that woman, those remain the property of the owner. The Eved, the slave here, can elect to stay on. Right? And the Torah here says, V'imamor yomara Eved, I love my master, probably because I love my wife and my children. I do not wish to go free. Then, V'higisho adonav ala Elohim, V'higisho ala delet ola mezuzah, V'ratza adonav et ozno b'martzea v'avado le'olam. So then, what happens? The master takes him to before God, before a court, before judges, and brings him to the door or the doorpost, and his ear is pierced. And once his ear has been pierced with an awl, then va'avado le'olam, he serves forever. In the rabbinic synthesis, that's understood only to be until the Jubilee year, but the point is it's well beyond the six-year period that the Torah initially limited his servitude to. So we have an amazing passage in the Talmud Bavli, which asks about some of the details of this passage. So can I have a volunteer to read the first paragraph here, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, in either language as you feel comfortable? You've heard plenty of my voice. Please.
Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai used to expound this verse as if it were a precious stone. Why was the ear singled out from all the other limbs of the body? The Holy and Blessed One said, "This ear, which heard my voice on Mount Sinai, when I proclaimed, 'For unto me the children of Israel are servants, and not servants of servants,' and yet this man went and acquired a master for himself. Let it be pierced."
Okay, so let's understand this first drasha. So what's the question here?
Why they pierce the ear?
Why the ear? Like, what is this about, this particular part of the body? And in the original, it's very appropriate. Ma nishtana ozen mikol evarim shebaguf. How is the ear? Why is the ear different? I translated it singled out, but it's manishtana. Manishtana, the ear, from all the other parts of the body. Okay? Why is that so? And so the answer is, because that ear heard on Mount Sinai, ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim. You are my slaves, and you are not, by implication, avadim la'avadim. You are not slaves to slaves if you allow another Israelite to buy you, but that Israelite is just a slave. Right? This really underscores this notion that we are not free after the Exodus. We are God's slaves. And actually, one of the consequences of that is it is inappropriate for someone to be sold to another Israelite. Now, this works because this is an elective move. Right? No one blames the slave for being sold into slavery in the first place. But here he has an out. And instead he says, Ahavti et Adoni. I love my master. I want to stay with him. Says Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, that ear has to have a kind of mark of Cain on it. That whenever it walks around, people will see, this is someone who didn't get it. Now put aside that his poor, the wife and kids are there. There's all kinds of reason why he might be there. But Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is using this moment to single out one of the core things that you should have understood from Mount Sinai is ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim. Now, by the way, the ear that heard on Mount Sinai, it's a very well-articulated phrase because that line, ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim, appears in Vayikra Kafhei, the 25th chapter of Vayikra, which begins, Vaydaber Hashem Moshe behar Sinai lemor. God said to Moshe, on Har Sinai, right? And the famous question, why? Right? Ma'inyan Shemitah, it's al Har Sinai. Why is that particular chapter singled out? But it's a chapter that is a Mount Sinai chapter. This Midrash is picking up on that, almost saying, the most important thing that was said at Mount Sinai is, you are my slaves. And you need to internalize all the consequences of that, among which are, none of you may own another person, and certainly none of you should ever electively go to be the slave of another master other than me when you have a choice. Okay? That's Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. Now let's move to the next paragraph, then we'll talk about these together. This ups the ante even further. If you paid attention, not only is the ear in this scene, but the door and the doorpost are as well. So maybe you can figure out where this is going. Why don't you give us the second half?
And Rav Shimon ben Rabbi used to expound this verse as if it were a precious stone. Why are the door and the doorpost singled out from all other items in the home? The Holy and Blessed One said, "The door and the doorpost, which were witnesses in Egypt when I passed over the lintel and the two posts and I proclaimed, 'For unto me the children of Israel are servants, and not servants of servants,' and I took them out from slavery to freedom. And yet this man went and fired a master for himself. Let him be pierced in their presence."
Okay, this is amazing. First of all, you again have this formulation, Manishtana delat u'mezuzah mikol kelim shababayit. Why are these things different? Why are these objects different from everything else in the house? Okay? And here, now we have an amazing retrojection. Because now the statement, ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim, the children of Israel are my slaves, which belongs at Har Sinai, belongs at Mount Sinai in chapter 25 of Vayikra, has now been retrojected as you almost imagine it's like a voice. You know, like in the Ten Commandments, like the green stuff starts coming out, right? The angel of death. It's like there's a voiceover at that moment when the force of death, the mashchit, is coming to kill the Egyptians. and God is saving the houses that have the blood put on the doorposts and on the lintels, there's a voiceover of Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim. Right? As if at the moment of liberation, God is making it very clear, this is not about you not being avadim, it's about you being my avadim. But then, most tellingly, what phrase does Rabbi Shimon bar Rabbi have no compunction using in parallel with this? V'hotzeitim me'avdut l'chayrut. That same phrase from the Haggadah, I took them out from slavery. I guess we thought chayrut meant freedom, but apparently whatever kind of freedom it means, it is something that's totally compatible with being told at the moment of emancipation, you are my slave. Right? Which should complicate now for us whether chayrut ever meant freedom in the first place. In other words, when Chazal, when the sages are using the word chayrut, do they even mean some Aramaicized form of chofshi? Or no, actually they understand whatever chayrut is, whatever this liberty is, to be some form of positive liberty. Some form of being liberated from an oppressor in order, through a new regime of service and expectation, to reach some kind of full flowering potential. Right? I know no other way of understanding this drasha otherwise, because it reads back, and I think part of what this is responding to is, in Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's telling of the story, you can sort of imagine that the journey out of Egypt was people oppressed, feeling totally constrained from being who they need to be, then being sprung free, having the experience of a kind of rumspringa to do whatever they want for a couple months until they get to Shavuot. And then there's a crackdown at Har Sinai. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed those 7 weeks. But now, avadai
him. Maybe that's why you had all the mountains over their
heads. Maybe all the mountains over their heads. Exactly. They were already accustomed to doing all kinds of things on their own. Rabbi Shimon bar Rabbi, I think, is in part responding to this and saying, no. It actually goes back to the moment of inception of this entire process. There was not a moment when the Israelites were ever actually not under some regime of expectation, servitude, even slavery, and God let them know that. And therefore, the delet and the mezuzah, which have no place in the desert story, no one has a delet and a mezuzah when they're wandering through the desert in tents. Those icons actually call back to mind Mitzrayim, being in the last moment that they were in a house, and that calls up this notion of, hey, when you last saw these things, I told you that you were supposed to be my Eved. And therefore, the ear is pierced because the ear didn't listen, but the man is pierced in the presence of the delet and the mezuzah because he did not internalize what the Exodus was about. Right? That's really what I would suggest to you this midrash is. It is saying the Eved Ivri, or the Hebrew slave, has failed to really understand that the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim is one that it is unfathomable, if you have internalized its message, that you would ever choose, when given a choice, to actually be subservient to someone else. Because you then don't get how you are God's servant in a full way. Yeah.
I might be jumping the gun, but I'm having a little bit of a hard time understanding how, if our quote-unquote freedom is really freedom from being slaves to other people, but enjoying the liberation that comes with being slaves to Hashem, then why do we aspire to be free next year?
Well, so part of what I'm suggesting is that once you problematize the word chayrut, and you understand that certainly in this text, chayrut doesn't mean you're not an eved in any sense.
Sure.
That line in Halachma is on some level perhaps best rendered as meaning, this year we are enslaved to all kinds of things that are either constraining our negative liberty in all kinds of bad ways that are not positive, or that are constraining our positive liberty in the sense that they are not allowing us to flourish. And next year, what we hope for is not to be free of all constraints, but to be b'nei chorin, which I'm on some level translating here in context as fully flourishing realizations of ourselves. It doesn't say we hope we'll be chofshi,
sure,
right? But that we will be b'nei chorin.
So would you say then that the b'nei chorin there is almost like next year we will return to the state in which we were immediately after Exodus?
Yeah, there is some element of that. I mean, that's a puzzling dimension of that line in general, because what does it mean, hashata avdei? Right? What does it mean now we're slaves? Right, that whole line is sort of weird. Most people who say that line in Jewish history have not actually been slaves at the moment they said it. So it clearly carries some metaphoric significance. And if we understand that the transition from Avdut l'Chayrut in rabbinic thought is actually the transition from Avdut Mitzrayim to Avdut Hashem, and Avdut Hashem in some way is being b'Chayrut, then that line would seem to be capturing that in some way, which is not the initial surface meaning, I think, that jumps off the page about it. Yeah.
So this passage I found particularly interesting. There's an obvious, very negative attitude towards what this indentured servant is doing, signing on for another 50 years, you know, or whenever, or less.
Yeah, until the Yovel, right, might be short.
You know, 5 years from now, whatever.
And in the pshat, it's forever.
50 years from now. And so they bring us to support the negative, they're bringing an example. See, I would have thought in a way that the difference in the two kinds of servitude is one is a matter of choice and one isn't. You're not choosing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of, you know, you're, but here they're having an example of somebody who's choosing. But once they've made that choice, it's no longer in their hands. They're no longer responsible for their time or their actions. They have to listen to what their master is telling them to do. And there is no longer any choice. So that's the only intrinsic difference that I can see between one kind of, you know, signing on to something. Having he has that moment of choice, and yet the rabbis are still down on him. And they're asking for something else. And what could make that kind of avdut servitude or work or whatever you wanted to find that word, edut or slavery, different, but maybe the constant renewal of that choice in every given instant and moment that you are free to do if you are an edut to God rather than, you know, in this contractual kind of situation.
Yeah, so this notion of the choice and the freedom, I actually think sits very much at the heart of what's at stake here and where Chazal are staking out some of their territory. Here, if you just look at the brief quote from Isaiah Berlin in his essay, Two Concepts of Liberty, I think it actually draws it out in very sharp form. He has a nice formulation here. For it is this, the positive conception of liberty, not freedom from, but freedom to lead one prescribed form of life, and now he lays out for you what the stark choice is, which the adherents of the negative notion represent as being, at times, no better than a specious disguise for brutal tyranny. Okay? The last part of the quote is very interesting, but the first part is laying out the distinction here, freedom from as opposed to freedom to. The biggest question I could ask about the rabbinic judgment of the indentured servant is, why can't a free man choose to be a slave? In other words, on some level, I could think of freedom as being the freedom to choose, right? And therefore, on some deep level, I would say, you could imagine someone in saying, there's no one more free than someone who, despite having an option to walk away, nonetheless chooses to be a slave. And therefore, why would we not see that as the ultimate expression of freedom from? I am free from expectation. I am free from anyone telling me what to do. If I want to be a slave, I'm going to be a slave, right? And the fact that Chazal and these rabbinic sources do not take that approach, I think is strong evidence that in this context, they are not thinking of freedom as freedom from. They are thinking of freedom as freedom to. And they are able to judge the indentured servant because, yeah, very nice, no one can force you. Even the Torah acknowledges if you want to be a slave, fine. But you're going to bear this mark in your ear, and you're going to have to stare at the lintel and the doorpost, which should remind you of the Exodus, to recognize as a slave, you can't fully realize who you ought to be as a full citizen of the community.
There are two. One of them has to do with what you're saying is freedom to do basically something that is worth doing. It's not, you know, signing on for 50 years to be a slave to somebody in you know, another human being, is that worth doing? You know, and then only married people, no. But the other point that I was making is it can be a question of the time. In other words, that when they're signing on in this case, once that decision is made, there is no longer any freedom in any moment. Well, anyone who decides to take on, you know, the burden of the Torah, decides to, you know, every single instant of their being, their time, they can decide otherwise. In every moment of their life, they're choosing to renew that thing. Every day they wake up in the morning, so that's a different take.
Yes, though even there, right, I think certainly from a rabbinic perspective, there's behavioral freedom at every moment, but there's not covenantal freedom at every moment. Right? In other words, a person can decide whether or not they will do or not do X or Y. That doesn't make X or Y any less expected of them.
Right.
And in that sense, particularly this notion of shtari kodeh, right, God saying, my deed is prior, right, to this other person's deed. There's some element here of that being simply incoherent given the conditions that have already been taken on. Right? We could go in much greater depth here on the ways that the different passages in the Torah actually seem to send very different conflicting messages, right? According to the Midrashic expansion of Sefer Vayikra, it almost seems like it is impossible to buy a Hebrew slave, right? Lo yimachru min keret ave, kitoshav, kisachir kitoshav yeimach. There is no way to have a Hebrew slave. And of course, though, the language and rhetoric in Mishpatim sounds like, well, now you can do it, but there's a lot of restrictions on it, and there's this kind of midrashic opprobrium attached to anyone who would voluntarily enter into it. And that itself reveals some kind of tension of, is this something you actually can undo, or is it just something, but you shouldn't, or is it actually something that you can't, right? It's actually impossible. And then I'll go on this side.
I was struck by the two different phrasing in Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and Rabbi Shimon bar Rabbi.
Yeah.
That in the first one is the ear that's pierced, and mm-hmm. the second one, he is pierced.
Mm-hmm.
As if, in the second case, he's kind of, in some sense, ruined as a whole vessel. There's something invalidated about the way he can be in the world, in the way that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is not.
That's nice. So meaning Rabbi Shimon bar Rabbi, not only is he pushing it back to Yetziat Mitzrayim into sort of the deeper into the DNA, that doesn't sound like a good metaphor, of the Jewish people and their history, but the effect on the individual is even more comprehensive. That's right. It's almost like with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the ear, there's a sign, this part of you didn't get it, but maybe the rest of you is fine. Here, your whole body, your whole essence. Very nice. I like that very much. Yeah.
One of the normative words you keep using, and I think is implicit in your pieces that you've selected from Chazal, underscore that there's a process involved. So it's just not the simultaneous text of slave, but simply put, but philosophers would look at it more profoundly, that there's a whole enduring process that it takes until there's a recognition of that, I'll use a word, ultimate freedom, which somebody might contextually say is slavery. In other words, we're all familiar, Al-Tikrei, Charut El-Cheru. It's that process until there's that internalization that piece of slavery is not really slavery, even though it's the same word that you juxtapose back and forth, but along that continuum until there's that recognition that really is, you know, freedom.
Right, so there's some kind of process to understanding what even is it makes us free, right? And that, I mean, the drasha that you're quoting, right, which appears in the Mishnah Avot and a number of places, which is even more powerful, which is, Yeah, the word charut, engraving on the luchot of stone that are the ultimate instruments of God's law, should be revocalized to be understood as charut, as some kind of freedom, which in that context, even more dramatically, clearly charut there does not mean freedom to do whatever you want.
Or maybe it does, but it's the recognition transitionally until you, I'll use a trite word, spiritually understand that is true freedom.
Right. Kofino to'achi omar rotzeani. Right? You apply enough pressure until the person internalizes. Now, I think what we're getting here, right, what we're getting at this point is to the place, and this is what the second half of Berlin's quote, I think, highlights and plays with, is there's a certain kind of language of that sort that can very easily lead towards fascism and to all kinds of other ways of thinking about societies where we essentially say, well, people don't really know what's good for them until the enlightened architects of the state set up the right kinds of policies to help them come to that deep internalization of what it is they really want. And we are rightly very skittish and nervous about that, particularly when it is played out through human power, right? These texts are clearly doing something different, and here's where the choice issue on behavior is actually key. Certainly for modern Jews, let's say living in the diaspora, where no one is actually coercing you to follow God's law, there is created there a sort of non-fascist space for a positive liberty conception here of more of, I think, what you're talking about, which is, what are the ways in which Yetziat Mitzrayim created the conditions where God could then legitimately expect things of us, which, if the mitzvot are properly understood and applied, will increase human flourishing, will increase human goodness, in a way that when you are the slave to someone else, their priorities will always come first. And to the extent that the Torah, properly understood and properly applied, will be the priorities that ought to be our own, well, then actually being liberated from other people's arbitrary priorities is critical for achieving that kind of liberty. But it's, again, it's that freedom too. It's somehow, can you step into the place where you will then do that, and you're not just searching for a way to get away from constraints. There's a difference with being free from constraints and being free from oppression. And the Torah is very clear that it wants to have there be freedom from oppression. Right? The other place with Chofshi appears, which you may remember from the Haftarah on Yom Kippur, is Vishalach Ritzutzim Chofshim. Send out all those who have been crushed free. Right? There the emphasis is people who are just being crushed, you want to get them out of there. But when you're talking about actually shaping some kind of covenantal destiny, being free to do whatever you want is actually not an acceptable or even a desirable endpoint. The question is, have you been liberated to unleash the possibility for your fuller potential? That's what I'm suggesting is embedded here. One more comment. We'll look briefly at Rav Hutton. We're not going to see the whole thing, and then bring it to a close.
So in English, we have all these different words that we've been like going between slavery, servitude, servants, slave, servant. And in English, these are meaningful distinctions, right? When I do service, that's very different than being enslaved, but in all these texts, the word is the same group, right?
Mm-hmm.
But is it totally anachronistic to apply that distinction to this sort of discussion, or are those actually meaningful distinctions that would kind of help us sort through this?
Yeah, well, I think you make a very good point, which is, if you can't articulate something, do you really have the concept? Mm-hmm. I don't know if some of you saw this recently. There was this article in The Economist about whether ancient people actually saw the color blue. Mm-hmm. Any of you see this? Mm-hmm. Right, so it was basically investigating that, like, there's not, it was a fascinating article, that in most ancient languages, there's not like a clear word for blue. So like the Greeks thought of the sky as silver, right? And there's all sorts of other ways that things are described, but the word blue is not there. And color is really interesting things, like red comes first in every culture, and then maybe there's a green or a yellow, etc. So what do you do with that, right? How do you sort of understand it? And I realize, by the way, is it actually true the word kachol does not appear anywhere in the Tanakh? Is that actually correct? It doesn't appear in the Torah, that's for sure. Well, I have this concordance right here, so we can look at it after. All right, in any event, why do I say this? And of course, the old meme about the Eskimos having 26 words for snow, which I think someone told me is not actually really true, but let's say they have more than one. So the idea is that nuance, right, that nuance of expression conveys a nuance of thinking. And this goes perhaps to Nachum's point also, which is it seems pretty clear contextually there are very different kinds of avadim, right? The avdei faro, who are quite prominent in the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, are clearly not a bunch of oppressed people who are lucky if they get dinner, right? They are some kind of exalt. They're only slaves to the extent that they sit below the king. They're more like cabinet ministers, though, who serve at the pleasure of the president, but that doesn't mean that they're slaves, right? And Eved Avraham is clearly some kind of figure owned by Abraham, but who is clearly treated in an extremely respectful way. Zakan Beito, Moshel Bechol Asherlo, he has tremendous kind of economic discretion. And then there are clearly Avadim who are doing Avodat Perech, some kind of crushing work. So what does it say? And then there's Avdei Hashem, right? Those who are serving God. What does it say? What's that?
Avod is also to worship.
And Avod is to worship. So what does it say that we only have one word for that, right? And that may get to some kind of sensitivity of, that does actually reflect a spectrum, right? Part of what we protect ourselves from in English is, oh, you call someone like hired help or a servant. Well, I never have a slave. Slavery is totally abominable. You actually drill down on some of the economic relationships and consequences. Not so clear it's black and white, night and day. Right? Depends on the relationship. But is it black and white? Is it a binary of someone's a slave or they're free? Or is there actually some range of what it is to be confined? And I think it's an excellent point as to whether the language of the Torah itself is conveying that. And what it means that, you know, I think Chazal sort of have this language of a ben chorin, a person whose description is they are free, right? In a way that doesn't seem to exist in biblical terminology, right? In other words, chofshi is an adjective, not a noun of a type of person in the way that an eved is. That bears further investigation. All right, so let me show you here the Pachad Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Huttner, amazing educator, Rosh Yeshiva, Darshan, survivor of the Black September hijackings, very illustrious and interesting person, has here a whole drasha of thinking about servitude and slavery. I'll refer to just a few things here off the translation on the back, so we save time of going back and forth, and then bring it back to the Seder and wrap up. Do some of this off the page and some of it read inside. Rav Huttner is bothered by why does what the rabbis understand to be the mitzvah of Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shamayim, the requirement to accept the authority of heaven, which is the daily twice recitation of Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Why is that the only mitzvah in the Torah preceded by Shema Yisrael? There's sort of this call to attention and to listening specifically in that mitzvah. And he says the way you have to understand that is by cross-referencing it with the drasha that we just heard about the indentured servant who pierces the ear, where we ask, why is the ear singled out? And it's because the ear heard on Mount Sinai, hey, Kili b'nei Yisrael avadim, you're my slaves, not these other people's slaves, so your ear has to be pierced. Ask Rav Huttner, just as I don't know why the verse Shema Yisrael is the only mitzvah that starts with the term Shema Yisrael, why is the only thing that warrants an ear piercing agreeing to be sold to another Jew? Why doesn't someone who eats pig get their ear pierced? Why don't we say the ear that heard on Mount Sinai, don't eat these things, should be pierced? Right? In other words, yeah, once he says it, you sort of realize if the problem is the ear didn't listen and obey something it should have, that should apply to all failures to obey anything that was said on Har Sinai. That's Rav Huttner's fundamental question. Okay? And here's what he says here in the third paragraph. Just going to read this to you. Only, and here he quotes a law from damages law in the Talmud, which you don't need to know the inside of, but you'll get it very clearly. Only when one causes someone to go deaf does one give him the value of his entire person. That's what the Talmud rules. Chersho notnein lo dmei kulo. If you, in a tort interaction, if you make someone go deaf, you give them their entire value that they would have on the slave block, as it were, before and after that happening. You give them their entire value. If one blinds someone, one pays only the value of the eye. Here's how it works. One who injures someone must pay the value lost were the person to be evaluated as a slave. The qualities of the ear make it the quintessential instrument of the status of slavery. The role of the ear in hearing is different from the working of all the other senses. All the other sensory parts of the body have internalizing and externalizing capacities. The eye receives images and projects outwards what it has experienced. That seems to indicate when you see a twinkle in someone's eye, or you have some insight into what they're thinking by watching their eyes, there's an externality to the eye. The nose is constantly sending things in and out of the body. The hand perceives through touch and actively reaches out. And even the mouth functions as an entry and an exit from the body. The ear, however, is strictly receptive. The ear can only be acted upon. Apparently he couldn't wiggle his ears, okay? But ear can only be acted upon. It itself cannot act. The state of slavery is characterized by complete and total dependence on the other, such that the slave has no agency whatsoever. Here we get to that autonomy question. The essence of being a slave is being in a constant state of readiness to receive orders from the other. Therefore, any damage to one's status as a slave is essentially a form of hearing loss. The ear must therefore be pierced specifically for violation of the commandment, Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim, because it's not just that the ear failed to hear something that God said, the ear failed to hear something about the ear. For those who are slaves to God, hearing is the most appropriate sensory expression of the content of slavery that ought to be in their hearts. Now here, the English is not good, because I'm rendering it as slavery, so you'll get the equation, but the Hebrew is, of course, the word avdut, which is this general, more encompassing, spectral term that invokes all these different kinds of relationships. And yet, what does Rav Huttner say? The ear is singled out in this drasha because what it means to be of service to someone is to listen and to respond. Right? That is what is distinctive about the ear. It is not about you. It is about you listening and taking in, and then you use your other senses in order to do what you need to do. And therefore, closing the loop, he says, this makes sense of the proclamation, Shema Yisrael. Why do you need to make a call to listen before you decree God's sovereignty that you say twice a day? Because that is the sense that has to be uniquely activated at that moment. When we say to ourselves, Shema Yisrael, we have to, in that moment, not just say, okay, God's above me, I have to prostrate and be crushed by this higher authority. I am actually supposed to be in a posture of listening, of taking in and responding. And because the ear that heard that at Mount Sinai ended up becoming a slave to another master, and therefore compromising his ability to listen to and respond to God, the ear has to be singled out. Now, Rav Huttner, I think, is not in any way, certainly explicitly or even implicitly, really playing with Berlin's notion of positive liberty, but I think it fits very, very well. Because the notion here is the import of Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim, which, as we saw in this drasha of Rabbi Shimon bar Rabbi, on some level that is the manifestation of what it means to go from avdut l'chayrut, from slavery to some kind of liberation. That is manifested by remembering the divine voice that called out, Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim, you are my servants, you belong to me. That dynamic of responding to God is played out in a deep way through the ear and through this understanding of what Yetziat Mitzrayim calls on us to do, which is this freedom too. It is actually a chance. What Pesach is marking is we are actually, as a result of being liberated from Egypt and whatever other political oppression since, free to realize our role and our destiny as servants of God. not simply in to enjoy the fruits of negative liberty, but to actually feel the responsibility and opportunity of positive liberty. So here's where I want to close that. I want to suggest for you that this may add one final dimension to a famous debate, which is how we begin the Haggadah. And that is in the Gemara laid out as a debate between Rav and Shmuel. The Mishnah says, we're back on the previous page, just the final two sources there. The Mishnah says, Matchil bignut u'mesayim b'shevach. The way, the cadence of the Seder is one that begins with a low place and ends up going to a higher place. And the question is, my bignut, where's the place that we start when we talk about our low origins? Rav says, Mitchila uvdei avodat gilulim ayu avoteinu. We start from a place of remembering how our ancestors were idolaters. And Shmuel says, Avadim hayinu. We were slaves to Paro and Mitzrayim. Now, on some simple level, what this is about is it a spiritual slavery or is it a political slavery? Are we marking the fact that this goes back, this journey, all the way back to the days of Terach, Avi Avraham, Avi Nachor, Vayavdu Elohim Achirim, before Abraham is really the story that we're starting with, and already Abraham is the first piece of that journey? Or is this a night that marks the political entity of Bnei Yisrael, the Israelite nation that existed, was oppressed in Egypt, and then set free? But there's another dimension of this which I wonder was on Rav's mind, which is a concern that if you only say Avadim Ayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim, you will get the impression that what we are marking is the triumph of negative liberty and the freedom from Pharaoh oppressed us. Kulanu Meshubadim Ayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim. The big story of tonight is we could have been slaves, but thank God we're not anymore. And why does he want Mitchila? Not only because of it being a deeper story, but because of what we say when we say that passage. Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoteinu, Ve'achshav Kirvanu HaMakom La'Avodato. It is a very striking passage where the Haggadah directly says, we used to be servants of Avodah Zarah, of foreign service, of foreign worship, and before the sentence even completes and you can say, hooray, we're free, it says, and instead, now we worship God. In other words, the Mitchila passage, to the extent it predates Rav, which it really clearly does, brings to the fore in the Seder, and I think he wanted you to start with that, a clear sense that, yeah, this is a journey from a certain kind of slavery and a certain kind of oppression, but to a different, dignified kind of service. Not just the celebration of being free from, but free to actually realize that potential. I offer you that thought going into your Siddurim and a way of rereading some of those earlier passages. May it be a great year ahead for freedom to do and achieve and realize all kinds of potential.